Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Yo dhammang passati so paticca samuppadang passati yo paticca samuppadang passati so dhammang passati ti. Which little saying at the very beginning gives the game away that this evening's talk is going to be on paticca samuppada, sometimes called dependent origination. Reason giving this talk this evening is because it is fresh in my mind, because I'm just going through a little transcript of a talk on that subject. But it also fits in very well with this time of the retreat. Again, that these talks towards the end of the retreat are focused on insight, practice, on Dhamma, understanding some of the nature of the important phenomena which we have to deeply look into. And focusing especially this evening on the Buddha's teaching of anatta, non-self. Very often that people make the very good complaints about the teaching of anatta, very good, as it were, remark about, observation about the teaching of anatta, saying that if there's nothing here, then what is this? Again, it shows, the question shows that the person has yet fully understood what the Buddha meant by anatta. However, that misunderstanding is very common in Buddhist circles, so much so that it forms the central plank of many Mahayana teachings on absolute emptiness. And I wanted to start this evening's talk on just pointing out that the dependent origination is the Buddha's answer to actually what is this in here. If it's not a self, if it's not a being, if it's not some sort of essence which keeps going on from time to time, from moment to moment, from day to day, from life to life, then what is it? Because it does not make sense to say there's nothing in here. There's a listening, there's a feeling, there's a knowing. So we have to make that answer to the question of what is this? And what the Buddha was saying is that that which is mistakenly taken to be a self. But it's sometimes even mistakenly to be taken as nothing altogether. And there's a very powerful sutta, which many of you know, it's in the Nidana Sanyutta called the Kacchanagota Sutta, where I mention this a lot because it is a very beautiful and far-reaching sutta which played a great role in later Buddhism. And in that sutta it says that for the most part beings usually fall into one of two ideas as far as the self is concerned. Either the self is as some permanent entity, forever lasting, from moment to moment, day to day, year to year, life to life, or they fall into the other extreme, the Buddha said, that there is nothing, nothing at all. And that is the teaching of absolute emptiness, that it's all illusion, there's absolutely nothing here. And of course either of those extremes don't match one's experience. And the Buddha said that both of those extremes are untenable, that they don't match experience, for the following reason. It's a very beautiful way the Buddha described this. He said, you can't say there is something because a passing away is seen. You can't say there's nothing because a rising is seen. And it's a very beautiful statement to really contemplate and go into. Now the idea of a self, a persisting being, a me, always depends upon this I, this me, this being, sort of lasting. And whatever you take to be a self, you can see very easily, if you're honest about it, if you have that power of the mind to go through wishful thinking and denial into the reality and truth of things, you can see that whatever you take to be a self is very impermanent. I say very impermanent because you see it just falls apart almost as soon as it arises. Now what do you take to be a self? Now who do you think you are? The body, the masculinity, femininity, your age, your intelligence, your achievements. Very quickly that one should be able to, at least rationally, push those aside. It's certainly not me, not mine, not a being. And you can see that these do fall apart very easily, very clearly. And you can see your body falling apart. If you don't think that your body is falling apart, look at some of the other members of this community here. It's very easy to see them falling apart. So those old monks here who have to go to dentists, who have to go to doctors, who are falling apart before your eyes, they're the great Dhamma teachers in this monastery, and we thank them very much for falling apart in front of our eyes. So that you can see this body is not you, you can see your intelligence isn't you. As little by little you start to forget things. You start to not be as sharp as you were when you were sort of in your 20s. And remember that each one of us faces Alzheimer's disease in the future. Maybe, a lot of us probably will, who knows. You're going to forget everything. So is your intelligence you? Is your knowledge you? And so all these little things we can actually push aside. There's not me, not mine, not a self. Is your gender you? So often we get so stuck in gender issues in our modern society. And you're not your gender. You're not a woman or a man. That's body stuff. Anyone who's got any deep meditation knows that the mind, which is far more central to the illusion of a self than the body, so easy to see. So this body just comes and goes, from life to life. One time a man, another woman, then a dog, then an angel, a deva, or who knows what else you can actually get reborn into. But that's not you, that's just a vehicle which you have for that lifetime. And it shouldn't be too hard to experience that for yourself. Experience the truth of that. That's what's in the suttas, that's what the Buddha said. So you're not your body. You're not sort of your gender. You're not your age. You're not your intelligence which comes to the mind. You're not your thoughts. It's marvellous to see how thoughts come and go. I change my mind very often. And sometimes in my position where being sort of the leader in one sense, I've got to make decisions on points of routine in the monastery or points of what is allowable, what isn't allowable. Sometimes I get into trouble because I say it's allowable last week and I say it's not allowable this week. And please accept that it's the just impermanence, the uncertainty of like even memory and thought. Sometimes you look at it one way and you think in one way, you think, oh yeah, that's allowable. And the next week you think of it from a different perspective and you say, no, it's the opposite. And it just goes to show that thoughts are uncertain. They can't be me. But how often do we believe our thoughts? We take our thoughts to be important, to be truth. We have angry thoughts at somebody, and we take those to be so true that we justify our ill will towards another beautiful human being or animal in this monastery. And it's just completely sort of irrational, untenable to do that. So after a while of meditating and watching the thoughts come and go in your mind, you should be able to very easily see you cannot rely upon the veracity or the truth of those thoughts. And it's a major insight, a major breakthrough to see unreliability of thinking. You can't rely upon it. You can't take it as absolute truth. And if you do, you get into trouble. You get into suffering. So after a while, you just look at these thoughts just like the babbling of a madman. Thinking, yeah, I know you. Just like some of these people who keep on talking, they never stop. And what they say is of not much use. If one can only look at thinking like that, it's not me, it's not mine, it'll disappear from us. So it's only because we take that to be a self. But as we look, we can see that's not a self, because there's a change, there's a falling away, there's a disappearance. That's why thoughts can't be a self, intelligence can't be self, even feelings, happiness, suffering, the emotions which go through our lives, they come and go, so we don't identify with emotions. Not identify with emotions means we don't sort of put ourselves in the center of these things and think we own them and think they're ours. We don't dress ourselves in these emotions. They're just something which is like winds far away, which just blow above us but never actually blow through us. No, they don't blow through us and make us move. Just like in the Ratana Sutta, just like the person who's seen the Dhamma, is just like the post stuck into the ground, is not moved by the four winds, the northeast, southwest winds. You're not shaken by emotions, you're not shaken by thoughts. You're solid and stable in that sense of being unshakable. And as we go further and deeper into these, what we take to be ourselves, even the consciousness and the doer, which I always focus on, and you've heard me say this many, many times, has actually got a justification in the suttas. I was reading it out in the Word of the Buddha class a few days ago, and pointing out that the doer and the knower, the last, as I call it, the refuges of the illusion of self, you can't say they're a self, simply because a passing away is seen of thinking, of doing, of will. In the Kacchanagota Sutta you say, because a passing away is seen, you can't say this is permanent, is persisting. You can't say it is, in the sense of persisting, even for a moment. And you can't say that consciousness is, because a passing away is seen. It's seeing the passing away of consciousness, seeing the passing away of will, of doing, is again the powerful experience, which you say that this can't be a self, because what is a self can never pass away. Maybe the aspects of a self can pass away, but the essence of it, the idea of an essence, is something which is not passing. So if because a passing away is seen, the Buddha said, you can't say ati, there is, basically meaning that there is a self, a me or a mine. And he said, nor, sort of, can you say there is nothing, because you can actually see that there is a body here, you can feel that body, you can know thoughts, you can know emotions. So just to say there's nothing and not take account of these things is again just missing the point of the Dhamma. It's not all emptiness. Nirvana and samsara aren't the same. They're hugely different. Men and women are different. Old and young, sick and healthy are not the same. If you think sickness and health is the same, that this is just a duality, then you'll never go to the doctors. But all people into non-duality still go to the doctors. It's just a scam. But if you actually go deeper, you see just in the realm of thoughts. Thoughts are, in a sense, that arising is seen. You can't say that they're just nothing. And you can say consciousness. When I say thoughts are, I was just meaning that you can't say that they are not. You can't say that consciousness is not, will is not. These are things which are, which exist, which come into being, which one has to take account of. So that because there is arising, the Buddha said, there's a rising of consciousness, you can notice that. There's a rising of will, you can notice that. You can't say there's nothing. So the idea of anatta is not there's nothing absolutely, emptiness. And the Buddha said that he teaches a middle way between those two extremes of absolute emptiness, there's nothing here, and sort of there is something persisting. And he said that middle way is dependent origination. It's a very powerful explanation of dependent origination. So when sometimes people say, well, if there's no self, what is this? Now, what is this consciousness? What is this will? What is this doing? What is karma, which is part of doing? Buddha said that karma is Chaitanya. It's doing. There is this. So what is it? And this is actually the pointing to this beautiful teaching of dependent origination, to show that what this is not a thing, but a process. A process is something in between, so not existing at all, and persisting for a long time. It's just like a flow, like a rolling process. And understanding the idea of process in Buddhism, just a cause leading to an effect, which itself is the cause of another effect, rolling on and on and on and on. But not to give those causes or effects a sort of a body. These are things which are momentary events. They're not themselves, as it were, like things. They're just causes which produce effects. That's all they are. So they're not something which is solid. It's like always moving. And whenever you try and pin it down, just like electrons or particles of an atom in quantum theory, as soon as you try and pin them down, you just don't know where they are anymore. The great Heisenberg's uncertainty principle also applies to things like consciousness and Chaitanya and all the five khandhas. As soon as you try and pin it down, it's not really there anymore. It's just this elusive, almost ghost, you know, half in existence and half not in existence, middle way between the two. And it's the idea of a process which keeps going on and on and on and on and on and on and on, of dependent origination. And they call it dependent origination because it shows the origin of things. If anyone wishes to answer that question, which is often posed by the theists, well then who created the world? And it's not sort of who, it's what, and that what is avijja, ignorance, delusion. That's the creator, not a god, not a devil, but avijja. It's not a being with sort of malice, or with compassion and love and goodwill, but it's just avijja, it's a process. And when one starts to see this thing we call life, consciousness, doing, will, so this is actually the best way, the most truthful and accurate way we can actually describe this whole process of what we take to be a self, what we take to be a being, what we take to be life. This causal process which lies between in the middle of being and non-being. And when you start to look at this process of khandhas coming and going, and seeing especially just the force which propels this process on and on and on and on, and you see that very much it's looked upon as being a mental process, knowing that the mind is the forerunner of all things, the mind is the chief, the greatest, the biggest thing in the world. I've been given this simile after lunch quite often, and this is like an old story just to lighten up this technical talk. As a friend from my university days who I still keep in contact with, we write to each other every now and again, and when he had his children, when he got married, one of his children was in the primary school, the first grade. Teacher asked the question, what is the biggest thing in the world? It was one of those questions you ask the little children just to get them to think. And one child said, my daddy is the biggest thing in the world. Another child said, no, an elephant is the biggest thing in the world. A third child said, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. And my friend's child said, the human eye, EYE, is the biggest thing in the world, because I can see her daddy, I can see an elephant, I can see a mountain and much more. If all those things can fit into my eye, if all those things can fit in, it must be much bigger than all of those things. Therefore, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. The logic of a six-year-old. And of course, you've heard me say this story before, even bigger than the human eye is the mind, because the mind can see everything an eye can see, and it can see what you can imagine as well. It can hear everything your ear can hear, and it can imagine sounds. It can smell, it can taste, it can touch, It can feel the touches of your body, and it can also imagine touches as well. It's got its own, its whole new huge territory, just mind stuff. So if all that stuff can fit into the mind, then the mind must be the biggest thing in the world, according to the logic of my friend's six-year-old daughter. The mind is the biggest thing in the world. It's a very beautiful saying. And when you start to look at that, and just how the mind is the biggest thing in the world, the mind is the chief, the mind is the forerunner, as the Buddha said in the Dharmapada. So we're looking at sort of this thing we call life and being as a mental process, because that is the forerunner, that is the chief. When you start to look at this process in terms of like a mental process, this is where you start to see the beauty of the dependent origination, focusing on the heart of things, but also involving sort of the body which is attached to this mind for a time. And when the Buddha started to notice this, you can start to see the whole process. Now, what is, how is worlds made? How are his mind states constructed? And you start to see this wonderful process of just how from craving and ignorance or delusion, blinded by avidya, ignorance, fettered by craving, and these two starting points of dependent origination. From those two points that one makes karma. As it says in dependent origination, from avidya you make the karma formations by body, speech or mind. Or if one starts from tanha, now from that craving that one constructs upadana. And those two are parallel processes, the same process of doing. Chetana, doing, will, is said to be karma by the Buddha. But that chetana, that doing, if it's a sort of rebirth-producing karma, it's also rebirth-producing craving and upadana. As we just chanted in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha's first teaching, when he defined craving, the cause of suffering, he said it's ponobhavika craving, which means craving which is inclining towards more rebirth. Rebirth in Pali is represented by the word ponobhava or punobhava. These are just two expressions of the same word, more existence, rebirth. And as we understand that this is the cause of rebirth, the cause of suffering is a craving which gives rise to rebirth. It's the karma formations which incline towards rebirth. This is the part of the process seen from two different angles, one from avidya, one from craving. And from that, you know, we create. Or rather the process sort of creates, the process rolls on into creating the grounds for existence, bhava, and the new jati, the new birth in your next life, in the next realm. The bhava is the realm, the jati is the birth into that realm, or the arising into that realm, if you want to be technical with the arupa and rupa lokas. And the vijnana, the new consciousness appearing in that realm. And you can actually see just this as a whole process, which you're doing now. Just this mind is rolling on, and the important thing which the Buddha was noticing, you can see just how this process, which we call mind, interacting with the world, the rupa kanda, with the body, with things. See how this interaction between the mind and things, that if it is craving or karma which is inclining towards rebirth, that is going to create that rebirth, another life in the future. And that, in dependent origination, the Buddha was saying, that is the danger. That is what we should be careful of. We should be worried about. If you're worried about anything, you should be worried about rebirth. Not about worried about what you're going to do when you leave this monastery. about worried about whether you're going to be healthy or not, you know, the sickness is going to go or not. Because rebirth is the problem. Because in the traditional, not the traditional, the essential teaching of dependent origination, it was not just showing how this process, what actually is this process of like consciousness and name and form and the six senses and the contact and the vedana, which is a combination of like sensory experience, as it were, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But also that when the Buddha was investigating dependent origination, then he started off with just like the suffering of life, expressed as soka parideva dukkha dhammana supayasa, which is just shorthand for just five types of dukkha, suffering. Just this is no suffering, soka parideva dukkha dhammana supayasa. And he wanted to find out what was the cause of suffering, why suffering? Why do babies die when they're young? Why do things go wrong? Why do we get frustrated? Why do we have to suffer illnesses? Why all this stuff? And in particular, that what I keep on saying is the most radical realization of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree at this particular stage was to see that such suffering was caused by birth. It was that first realization, the first starting of the understanding of dependent origination, which was starting to shatter sort of the wishful thinking of lifetimes. That wishful thinking of lifetimes is that once you're born, somehow or another, by ascetic practices, or by being wealthy, or by finding your ideal partner in the world, or by whatever it is, by power, that somehow you can have life without suffering, without dukkha. What the Buddha was saying by that realization was that once is birth, there is inevitably dukkha, suffering. And the only way out of that suffering is to stop being reborn in your future life. To stop rebirth. In this life, as it were, it's a bit late. You've already made the seeds of this life, of this body, of this mind, of these five khandhas. And he realized that these five khandhas, in their very essence, are suffering. To feel is to suffer. To see, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, is by its essential nature suffering. And you've heard me say before how the experiences of jhanas make that just so clear. The reason why they're blissful is because the pain of the five senses is gone. If you've always been experiencing that pain of sensory experience, the five senses, you never know it's painful, you take it for granted. Take a course, you know, this is ordinary, this is normal. Once those five senses have disappeared, then you realize the five senses are pain. As you go through the jhanas and the sixth sense starts to get less and less and less. As it gets less and less and less and starts to fade away, diminish, it gets more and more happy. And you realize that the mind is also painful. The jitta is dukkha. This is a realization which is not that hard if you can go through a few jhanas. That's what they say, I was saying last week, standing upon that, you can realize this is sankata, these are made. And whatever's made is subject to passing away and suffering. Standing on that realization, you realize even the mind, the jitta, which is what you're experiencing in jhanas, this is pure jitta experience. Just like the goldsmith has refined gold, taken all the impurities out of it. Just got gold and other elements. Pure gold, 100% gold, 100% jitta in the jhanas. You see, that sense too is dukkha. What you're understanding there is that you're stuck with this jitta. You're stuck with these other khandhas, other senses. because of past karma, because you've been reborn. And it makes the release from suffering, the path towards enlightenment, just very plain. That whatever you do in this life, you're not going to end suffering in this life. Jati pachaya dukkha. And even actually there's another sutta in the Sutta Nipata, I think, that says wherever there's vijnana, there's dukkha. Where there's consciousness, there's dukkha. And the ending of dukkha is the ending of consciousness, of vijnana. Having understood this, you know, one, the whole purpose of life changes. You're not looking for happiness in this world, in this life, by going to the perfect monastery, by getting perfect health, by finding a perfect partner, by becoming rich. Because whatever you do in this life, in this world, whatever you do, even if you get into jhanas, you've got a great mind state, still suffering in this world. Still sensory experience in the very highest. Even if you get to some heaven realm, whatever heaven realm you can imagine, suffering. What's happening here is you're realizing, because jati pachaya dukkha, that once is birth, it is dukkha. That's the cause of it. Jati, birth. Understanding that, you know that anywhere in samsara, in whatever most refined state of the five khandhas, refined state of consciousness, or whatever, anywhere throughout, in any little corner, dukkha, suffering. It's like an apple which has got no parts which aren't infected by the disease. You can't cut away pieces and just keep the pieces, this tiny piece which is not being infected by the disease of dukkha, and keep that. There's nothing which can be kept. And seeing that is actually where the nibbida towards the five khandhas, towards life, towards even citta, comes up. And that's why the Buddha said he does not praise or recommend, is a better word, any bhava, any existence in any of the realms. There is no such thing as a happy heaven realm. These heaven realms are just a little bit happier than the human realm. You can't say they're absolutely happy in the sense that going to those places will never be any dukkha for you ever again. Understanding this, you understand the power of that first insight into causes and effects. Because that just changed the whole paradigm of the search for happiness. Realizing it cannot be found in this life. It can only be found through ending rebirth. And the whole of the idea of samsara, the wheel of births, as being something which is unattractive, was very clear in the mind of Buddha, in the Buddha, and obviously was an important teaching of Buddhism for the centuries afterwards. And so the problem came to the Buddha is actually, having been born now, okay, you've got to, as they said in the jails, cop it sweet, but how am I not going to get reborn again? How is this going to be the last birth? And that becomes just the whole purpose of the practice of bhavana. Not to get into jhanas, not to get stream winner, not to get arahat per se, but those are means to the end of how we can stop getting reborn in the future, how we can make this our last life. Of course, many people will sort of go into denial in that respect, saying, no, the world is happy that you monks have just stuck up yourselves. Get a life, Ajahn Brahm. And it's not I've had enough lies, I don't want to get a life. I'm fed up with this one. So it's not just getting another life or get a life in this existence, it's actually getting out of life. And this is, understanding this, it changes the whole purpose of what you're doing here. You're trying to stop rebirth. And you know that one of my favorite sayings, you know, from the great Arahat Sariputta, the wisest person, said by the Buddha, the wisest of all the disciples, whose wisdom was only just a little bit less than the Buddha himself, when asked by a wanderer, who like many people was in a hurry, just, you know, give it to me quickly, what is happiness and what is suffering? What do those two words really mean? What is real happiness in this world? Why is there suffering? And just in those immortal words, the Sariputta said that rebirth is suffering. Not getting reborn is happiness. Such a powerful statement, which when I first read it just really resonated so deeply inside of me. I always remember that. So getting reborn is suffering. Not being reborn is happiness. So from what's ultimate happiness, it's not getting reborn. That's what Nibbana is, Paramangsukhan, the end of things, cessation, gone, finished with all this life business. So the whole thrust of Buddhism becomes, why are we always reborn? Why do we come into this life? And the whole purpose of the dependent origination is to show why we get reborn, to answer that question. What is the seed of rebirth for the future? And once we understand this, the whole idea of paticca-samuppada dependent origination gets very clear. Why do we keep getting reborn? And you start to see from that bhava, just bhava is almost part of birth. And from upadana and tanha, from craving, the types of craving which lead to rebirth, from the Dhammacakka Sutta, and upadana, and taking up these things. What some people call clinging, but I prefer taking up, or fuel is one of its meanings. We actually fuel the process with upadana. And imagine the idea of fueling. What are those fuels? There's the fuel of self-view. The fuel of siddhabhata paramasa, thinking one can get enlightened, get off the wheel, you know, through some sort of virtue or particular type of practice by itself. And the view of a self, dittupadana. And lastly, kamupadana, the view of happiness in the five senses, or sort of like the taking up of the five senses as a vehicle for happiness, rather. And especially that three quarters of upadana, all caught up with the sense of self. So when there is a self, that idea of me is the fuel which gives rise to rebirth. Once there's an I, there will be a mine. This is what an I does. It is its function. You know a thing not just by what it's made of. You know a thing by what it does. The microphone is known as a microphone in front of me, not just because of the component parts, but because its function to receive sound and turn it into electrical impulses. You often know a thing by what it does. So what is an I, a self? You can know it by what it does. It owns and controls what it thinks it owns. That's the whole purpose, function. An I is there to do, to know, and then to respond. This is the knower and the doer in action. And because of that delusion, that is the fuel which keeps this whole process going. There's also the fuel, the upadana of kamupadana, seeking for pleasure, for satisfaction in the realm of the five senses. That's what makes the world go round. Not love, but craving makes the world go round. The craving in here, talking about seeking for pleasure in sight, sounds, smell, tastes, and physical touches. Seeking for sex, for pleasurable movies, for beautiful music, for wonderful sights, for experiences in the five senses, through skiing, through paragliding, through exploring sort of the Amazon, whatever else is what people do in the world, and what they spend all their money on, what they work to do, isn't it just to explore the pleasures of those five senses? That is the fuel which keeps you going again and again through the worlds of samsara. The Buddha said there are three things you can never get enough of: sleep, food and sex. The more you get, the more you want. And it goes on and on and on. There's no end to those three sensory pleasures. It's interesting, the Buddha said sleep in there as well. As a sensory pleasure. This is where that we seek that sensory pleasure in comfort, in ending the irritation of the five senses. That is still karma dhanha and karma upadana, the fuel of finding comfort in sight, sound, smell, tastes, and especially in touch. I've said before that every time you move the body, why do you move? Why do you scratch? Why do you fidget? Why do you even blink the eye? It's all because of karma dhanha, the craving to find comfort. Why do you put on the heaters? Why do you get the blanket? Why do you lay down after a long period of meditation in the evening to go to sleep? Why do you do that so often? To try and find some comfort in this physical body, the comfort of touch. Why do you go to the toilet? Do you find that comfort? If there was truly comfort in this body, with the comfort of this fifth sense of touch, you would not need to move. All movement is a sign of discomfort, a sign of dukkha, suffering in the fifth sense of the body. It's powerful to realize just how much dukkha is in this body of ours. That's why we always have to be on the move. Even in the great pleasures of sex or drugs or music, people are always moving and fidgeting. It's not that comfortable. It's just an illusion of comfort. And this is, again, one of the realizations. The one time in my life when the body doesn't have to move is when we're in deep meditation. It's the only time the body doesn't disturb. Basically, when it's disappeared and gone. Powerful realization to just realize how much dukkha is involved in this body. If there wasn't, you wouldn't need to move. Maybe you can stay absolutely still for a few seconds, outside of meditation this is. But a few seconds and there's more dukkha, something more to deal with. Even the movement towards comfort is karma dhanha and upadana. And after a while you realize there's no comfort to be found in this body, there's no pleasure to be found in the five senses. And actually realizing that means you don't give up hope for pleasure in those six, five senses. Sometimes we think, okay, maybe in the next life we can get some happiness. I think maybe that if you be a good monk, then you can actually get reborn in some heaven realms with 1,000 black-eyed nymphs, or whatever else you want in life, with as many fish and chips as you ever want in a world where there's no cholesterol. Whatever else you want in the world, people have some crazy ideas of what they want. Perfect partner. Years ago, I remember talking to this crazy Sri Lankan woman. She was about 45 or 50. And she said that somewhere out there, I always remember these words, is my partner, the one who was made for me in heaven. I know he's out there, it's just I haven't found him yet. Oh, damn it. But I know he's out there somewhere. She was almost an old lady. And she was still thinking that somewhere there'd be this romantic partner just for her. She was also quite ugly. But she was still so hopeful. It was just complete, absolute idiocy. But you can see that people always hope and always think that, you know, somewhere in samsara there'll be my perfect body. You know, we go to all these naturopaths and stuff, thinking that someone's going to cure you. It won't cure you. Maybe you get a little bit better for a little while, but you're going to die. You're all going to get sick and old. And some people are further along that path. They're more advanced than the rest of us. They're called more advanced. And they're all going to go around that path. There's no hope in samsara. Every bit of bhava existence is like a lump of shit, the Buddha said. And even a tiny bit on your finger stinks. This is not being negative, this is actually being realistic, and it's important realization. This is truth. And it's that saying that, you know, happiness at last, to know there's no happiness in this world. That wonderful oxymoron. At last you realize why this whole search for comfort in this body is just a waste of time. The search for pleasure in this world is a waste of time. And that cuts at the sense of self, which the sense of self said, it's not a waste of time, there must be something I can do. And you realize there's nothing you can do, self. You're not in control, you don't own anything. This is all belongs to nature. You know, from vijnana pachaya nama rupa, nama rupa pachaya sala yatana pachaya paso pasa pachaya vedana. It's just nature. If there's a feeling to be felt as suffering, it's suffering. If there's a feeling to be felt as happiness, it's happiness. It's not what you want. It's nature. And you can't do anything about it. It's part of having a sensory mind and body. If you have senses, you will feel. What you feel will never be under your control. You can't just have happiness. In fact, the more you try, the more suffering you find. The less you try, the more happiness, but you can't get absolute happiness. You just go to heaven realms in this world. Heaven realms where it's much easier when you start letting go. But it's still dukkha. Still not perfect. It can't be perfect. Because jati, birth, gives rise to dukkha. It's the cause of dukkha. So after a while, we really let go. This is what we call really letting go. We realize the I doesn't own anything. It can't control anything. I can't control mind. This I is supposed to be the mind. So it can't control itself. What can it control? It doesn't own itself even. What a wonderful realization. The chitta doesn't own the chitta. Therefore the chitta is just rising and falling, passing away. It doesn't even have power over itself. Remember, to be is to control, to do, to own something. When you see that nothing is owned, there's no doing. This is just a process. And then you start to realize just the seed of rebirth is starting to be uprooted. The whole purpose of this is to see the fuel, the seed, karma formations, jhana, will, or seeings of dhanha and upadana, craving and building up the fuels for rebirth, cutting those, stopping them. And of course the root of all this, you can't just stop craving and just will yourself to stop willing. This is obviously makes it stupid to even think that way, to crave to stop craving. What one does is always remember the Buddha didn't just teach dependent origination. He also taught dependent cessation. You know, I can't see why that in the translations of Paticca-samuppada, they don't actually, they always call it dependent origination. But that's only half of the Buddha's teachings on Paticca-samuppada. There is a cessation mode when avidya ceases completely. Then so do karma formations. When karma formations cease, then so does the rebirth consciousness and all the consciousnesses which follow afterwards. I like the word consciousnesses. It sounds difficult in English because we think consciousness is one and the same from moment to moment. But consciousnesses gives the impression these are fragmentary moments which is not just one thing, but a whole series of hundreds, thousands, millions of consciousnesses flowing one after the other. Plural, not singular. Plural in time. And when we start to see that from karma formations we get consciousnesses for the next life, and consciousnesses have to have the objects of consciousness, nama rupas, name and forms, or I prefer objects of consciousnesses. And from those that we have to have the six sense bases to actually to know these things, and contact and Vedana. Once there is this, there's Vedana, there's always happiness, there's always suffering. You can't have one without the other. That's the duality of this world. And the only place you'll have non-duality is in cessation. Every consciousness has to be dual. There cannot be any knowing of non-duality. To know one thing is to not know something else. That's why vijnana, wit, the same word as by, it's a discrimination. Cannot bring everything together. When you bring everything together, is what you haven't brought together, is the opposite. There's no idea of non-duality here. The only place where there's non-duality is where there's none, nothing, gone, cessation of nibbana. And so that from the way to know of happiness and suffering, that happiness, as you know, is just the pause between two moments of suffering. Suffering is just the pause between two moments of happiness, the dance of night and day, of which we, if you're going to have one, you've got to have the other. It should be obvious to people. You can't just have happiness, 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 happiness forever and ever and ever. And what happiness is more happiness than usual. Suffering is slightly less happiness. For those who are having a lot of suffering, just if it's a good day, you're still suffering, but it's happy because it's not as bad as it was yesterday. That's all happiness and suffering is. Just a bit better than it was yesterday, and it's happy. A bit worse than it was yesterday, that's suffering. Please know what happiness and suffering is. They run around each other, and you can't have one without the other. This is why the teaching of Vedana is so powerful. And you see, for when Vedana ceases, there can't be any cravings, there can't be any fuel. It's like the fuel line has been cut off of your car. If you cut the fuel line off your car, upadana is stopped, ceases without remainder. What happens to your car? Does it stop automatically? It keeps on going for a while. It's got momentum. Where did that momentum come from? From the past. It takes a while to slow down and stop. That's why when upadana, or rather when sort of the avijja is cut, it takes a while to stop. If only a little bit of upadana is stopped, the ditupadana and the atavadupadana, the sense of self, then you've only cut off a bit of the fuel. You've still got enough fuel left to go for another seven lifetimes sometimes. If you cut off the whole of avijja, upadana is cut, and the momentum still carries you for many years. Until when that upadana stops, it's called parinibbana, complete ending cessation. This is what we call dependent cessation. When that upadana stops, there is no more birth, no more jati. No more old age, suffering, death, and all this sort of stuff. No more listening to Dharma discourses. No more having sort of diarrhea. No more sort of having toothaches. No more having to go through all this life business. And all this sensory experience of the mind and the body. To sense is to suffer. But people want to sense because of the I, the sense of self. That is the root problem. And when that seed is cut off, the seed of the illusion of self, then the whole of dependent origination just falls apart. Just like the pack of cards, when one card, the foundation card, is moved and taken away, this whole pack of cards called life, the universe and everything, completely falls apart. It starts to tumble. And you start to see the tumble of samsara, the attainment of sotapanna. You can start to see you've taken the pin out, and the whole vehicle starts to wobble, shake, and you know it's falling apart, hour by hour, day by day, life by life. Can't last much longer. Just going on the momentum of the past karma, the delusions from the past. And so dependent cessation becomes this beautiful teaching of the Buddha, to see the way out of samsara. But not only see this way out of samsara, to see this process, which was not a self process, not a being, just a process of cause and effect, halfway between being and halfway between nothing, is literally coming to the state of nothingness. True emptiness, true nothingness, is parinibbana. Just after the arahat lays down the khandhas, or you can't really say, it's so difficult in English to find words, because no one is laying down anything. Just when the process stops, comes to an end. Sometimes people think that, what about the physics law of conservation of energy? There can't be nothing left afterwards, you know, because energy has to be conserved. There has to be, you know, something there afterwards, if there was something there before. That's a very good point. And I answered, by there was nothing there before, so there doesn't need to be anything thereafter. Nothingness is being conserved. It's a conservation of nothingness. And that's much more close to the truth of things. Afterwards, that process, that little blip on sort of emptiness, is now gone, finished, stopped. It's the end, samsara. This is what the Buddha saw, and this is what dependent origination was such a powerful teaching. It's a powerful teaching because not only does it sort of show just why one gets reborn, it also shows that rebirth, ipso facto, by its very nature, is going to be suffering. It explains why you may have been searching around for happiness in this world, you haven't found it yet, you're not going to find it. It's like a con man who's trying to sell you something which is not really worthwhile. Life is that con man trying to sell you a bummer of a car called life. And so many people sort of buy into that con man and buy a life. And they say, okay, well, this vehicle was not good, but I've got a really good deal for you next lifetime. Sign up. And this is the illusion of life. Just thinking that we are going to find happiness there. That dependent origination shows that there cannot be any happiness to be found there. All bhava stinks. All existence. And in the highest of realms, the Buddha never praised, never recommended. Then, having seen that part of dependent origination, one sees the seeds which give rise to rebirth. And it points out the process, it points out the seeds, the causes. And as soon as the causes are pointed out, because they are pointed out, that by itself starts to unravel avijja. You don't unravel avijja. It's somebody else pointing out this, unravels it for you. It's called paratagosa by the Buddha, words of another. Once that's pointed out, maybe paratagosa is not strong enough yet, but it's put again and again and again, these teachings. And then the causes, the paratagosa, as it were, causes yonisamanasikara to go in a good direction. Going in a good direction. When someone suggests these things, whether you like it or not, you're going to investigate in that area. We haven't got the choice of what we investigate. Someone suggests this, I'm not going to investigate, I'm not going to, but you do. I remember just many years ago when I was a school teacher and I took some kids to not much meditation going around in those days in the West Country of England, and there was this Christian guy teaching some meditation, so I took, you can, when you're in school you can get a bus and the school pays for it, so I just was interested in checking this guy out, and I got actually a few kids to go along with me, just on a completely sidetrack. So one of the kids I took there, I actually saw him later on when I went to visit the Devon Vihara in England. He came actually to see me, asked if I remember him. I said, no, not at all. I taught him Mass, but more than that, I actually took him on this expedition to see meditation. He said it changed his life. He was actually the religious instruction teacher at the school now. But anyway, that this guy and this, he did say a few interesting things. I remember he told the whole audience, he said, okay, now I'm going to ask you not to think of a white horse. You can think of anything except a white horse. Don't think of a white horse. What you're thinking of, a white horse. It just showed you just how out of control you were. And just suggestion, as any psychologist or advertising executive knows, is so powerful. Paotagosa is the suggestions, the advertising campaign set up by the Buddha to take you out from samsara. And that will cause yonisamanasikara, will cause you to go looking in that direction. And go to start looking at the illusion of a self, this thing I take to be me, this thing, the process, life, being, self, whatever you take yourself to be, this. Now in Hinduism, they got this stupid saying, I am that. You look at that. You look at that. Patita Samuppada is that. Not I, but dependent origination is that. Tat Tvam Patita Samuppadam is Buddha's saying. The process. Once you see it as a process, not as an I, not a self, the whole of samsara starts to shake, just like in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. All those heavenly realms shaking and trembling because of what's happening here. The whole of samsara, the pack of cards, is trembling. Things are going to fall down if you keep going in this direction. And you find that this is truth. This is Dhamma. He who sees the Dhamma, or she who sees the Dhamma, whatever, the process which sees the Dhamma, starts to unravel and stop. Once that process sees the Dhamma, then the Dhamma stops the process. And that which you took to be a self all these years, the one you thought you were, this is not nothing there. There's not something there, the beautiful middle way of the process, rising and falling. When you start to see that degree of rising and falling, there's nothing which is rising and falling, it's just rising and falling. If you want to say anything rising and falling, as in Kachana Gota Sutta by the Buddha, it's just dukkha arising and dukkha passing away. The whole process is by itself suffering. We actually see life. You know, what is life? If anyone asks you that very deep question, what is life? You can answer, suffering arising, suffering passing away. That will blow them away. They think you're crazy. It's not what they expect. Life is a bowl of cherries. Life is love. Life is a search for God. Just life is just expressing your love, relationships. As an old monk, you say, life is dukkha, rising and passing away, that's all. I remember sort of seeing a Catholic priest once was picked me up from the station in Bumby to take me to the prison. And he went down the beach, this beautiful beach in Bumby on a wonderful sunny day. And he said, Brahm, what does the ocean speak to you? And I said, the ocean speaks to me impermanence. I remember him scowling at me. He didn't like that at all. I remember that. It's just, I really sort of upset him because he thought, no, it speaks to me of like sort of permanence, God, eternity. So that's not what it speaks to me. Anyway, that you can see this process and see it as it truly is. There's nothing which is going to last there, just arising and passing away. The middle way between is and is not. Seeing that you don't own anything. No fuel. From seeing that, the whole thing stops. It's from the understanding, the penetration of non-self, which brings, or is accompanied with impermanence, with dukkha, with suffering. You see me going backwards and forwards between these three amazingly beautiful, beautiful words. These are the three jewels, not the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta. The three jewels, well, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha's three jewels, they're very beautiful, but the real jewels, just the real precious stuff is anatta, dukkha, anatta, because that gets you off the wheel. The three keys which unlock the doors of samsara and stop all this suffering business. And this is actually where it all ends. So that's what dependent origination is all about. It explains what this is. Tat tvang paticca sammuppadang. Understanding what this is, you can actually see it clearly. It's not a self, it's not a me, it's not a mine, it's not a being, it's just this process. You can see it very clearly when you put it in that framework. You can see just how it rolls on from life to life. You can see just it's not really worthwhile. It's just a dud of a process. And when you see it as a dud of a process, that will give you, naturally, the process will see itself as a dud, and nibbida towards that process, this revulsion towards this process, will start to make viraga, the whole thing starts to fade away. What fades away is the seeds, the energy source of the process, the momentum of the process starts to fade, and eventually goes to cessation, nirodha, when the whole thing stops. The whole machine stops. And that stopping is the end of suffering. That's nibbana. And that's what Paticcasamuppada called dependent cessation, is all pointed to brilliant, beautiful teachings of the Buddha. And it's a privilege to talk about them this evening. A1.
Sūpatipanno bhagavato sāṅkhaṃ.